Hello, and thanks for joining us in Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices. I'm Joanna Hernandez. Here's what we're looking at. More than 2,000 students may have to find new schools as a charter operator plans to shut down 7 locations. We sit down with Mayor Johnson's chief of staff to talk about Chicago public school funding. A new Chicago Stories documentary dives into the history of the Young Lords of Lincoln Park.
I wanted to honor my father in going through the process.
And how organ donation impacted a local family. And now to some of today's top stories. Parents and teachers are feeling blindsided this morning after finding out about potential school closures. That's after Acero Charter Schools announced its plans to shut down 7 of its campuses, impacting more than 2,000 students. The board of directors last night adopted a resolution that allows for what it calls a strategic reorganization of school operations. It would lead to the closures of Cruz K through 12, Casa Ciceros, Fuentes, Paz, Santiago, and Tamayo elementary schools. Acero says the plan was spurred by declining enrollment and increasing personnel and facility cost. The closures, which are not finalized yet, would happen next June. Also slated for closure is a migrant shelter in Little Village. State officials say the shelter, which opened in January at the height of the crisis, now houses 146 people. Officials say they will be offered spaces in one of the 14 migrant shelters the city will continue to operate, and the effort will be made to keep children close to their schools. It's the fourth shelter to be closed by state and city officials since the beginning of October. The shelter is set to close November 3rd. While Chicago and its school districts are grappling with deficits and possible property tax hikes, Cook County's budget plan has no new tax, fees, or fines or fees. Board President Tony Perpwinkle is proposing a nearly $10 billion budget that she describes as a good news budget. Perpwinkle says the budget plan and the county's financial situation are the product of smart policy over the years.
We avoid using one-time revenues for recurring expenses. We don't borrow more than we need. We don't spend more than we have. And we don't do quick fixes. Instead, we've committed ourselves to finding structural solutions to balancing our budget.
Perpwinkle's plan includes investments in opioid addiction initiatives, community violence intervention, and adding employees at the assessor's office to help with property valuations. However, next year will bring a temporary hiatus of the guaranteed income program, but Perpwinkle says the plan, she plans to bring it back. A final vote on the budget is scheduled for November 21st and joins us Monday night when Tony Perpwinkle joins us to break down the proposal. And Paw Chicago is helping animal shelters in Tennessee that were impacted by Hurricane Helene. Volunteers this afternoon returned to Chicago and brought back more than 20 dogs and puppies that were already in shelters before the storm hit. A spokesperson with Paw says by taking in the animals, it allows local teams to focus on rescuing and reuniting displaced pets in communities that were impacted. The dogs will be available for adoption in a few days, with the puppies in a few weeks. Keep an eye on Paw Chicago's website and social media for updates. Up next, the mayor's chief of staff joins us in studio with the latest on funding for Chicago public schools. That's right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
All eyes have been on Chicago Public Schools this week. A quick recap. Mayor Brandon Johnson named his new picks for the school board after the entire 7-person board announced their resignation. This as tensions are still flaring between the mayor and CPS CEO Pedro Martinez, who he wants out. And maybe the most pressing question, how will the city solve the district's financial crisis? And joining us here to tell us more is Mayor Brandon Johnson's Chief of Staff, Cristina Pasion Zayas. Thank you for taking the time for being here. So I want to start. We had Mayor Brandon Johnson on Tuesday's show where he maintained that those who oppose his vision also oppose progress. Let's take a listen.
Once upon a time, black children were stuffed in Willis wagons because the school district refused to invest in them. Once upon a time, you know, we had black teachers in particular, black women overwhelmingly have been laid off. That's what's being proposed right now. The people who oppose my vision, the vision that the people of Chicago voted for, they want to take us back to cuts and closures and privatization.
And as a state senator, you push for more state funds for education. Why hasn't the mayor's office been able to convince state lawmakers and the governor to help Chicago bridge the gap?
Well, I would actually have to say that we've been working closely with the governor's office. Our financial team, as well as the governor's office financial team, are in close communication and coordination, looking at not just a situation where we're bailing out CPS or we're bailing out Chicago. We have some structural issues that we have to address. COVID dollars are expiring. We have diminishing returns on revenues, such as the personal property replacement tax, and that's because Trump had lifted the caps and corporations are able to write off more and not put money into the revenue stream, which is basically now creating the deficit that we have for 2024 and some of the forecast of 2025. These two teams are working on strategies that will assist all municipalities across the city to deal with both of these issues.
And as we also know, CEO Martinez spoke with our colleague Brandis Freeman last night. He details some of the private conversations between himself and the mayor. Let's take a look at them.
We were very disappointed, Brandis, that what we got back was, even though they saw we can't make any more cuts, you made all the cuts you could make, you should really think about, you know, you should really borrow. And we took the position of, okay, maybe they don't understand the history or the risks the CPS has in borrowing, because we went through this path before. Back in the years of 15, 16, and 17, the district took out $2 billion in loans and refinancings. And today, Brandon, is in my deficit. I am paying $194 million in interest-only payments. So we put that in a memo, shared it with the mayor. I even shared with him privately that I really didn't feel he was getting the best counsel. He listened, came back, still insisted on the loan. My board said, we cannot.
Now, is it possible for the city to use more than $300 million in funds, which are now reserved for TIFs, to fill CPS budget deficit?
So the mayor and the CEO did have a conversation about TIF surplus. There was always a commitment to meet that obligation per statute. With the TIF surplus, though, what we also have to understand, those dollars also go back into other taxing bodies, such as the parks, such as the libraries, city colleges. In this whole budget cycle, we are working out the analysis to figure out how much actually can go into the school budget. But I think what's important to note is that the budget that was passed back in July did not include all of the expenses that CPS actually has to account for. That is inclusive of settling the contract with teachers and settling the contract with principals. This is the first year that principals are actually collectively bargaining. I actually participated in the process of establishing that particular bill. They also didn't include a pension payment for the employees that are non-teachers. So what was presented in July was not even a full picture, yet in past budgets, we have been able to get CPS to make a commitment towards their pension payments, which they should, because as they move into an independent school district, they have to independently cover the costs of their expenses. No other sister agency expects the city to pay for their pensions. And yet, in this particular case, CPS does.
Just seems there's just so many layers, so many opinions. I have to ask, if Martinez is pushed out, what's the likelihood you'll be considered for the job?
No, I'm the chief of staff to the mayor. I'm not going anywhere.
I mean, would you do something differently in that role if you were considered for that job?
The advice I would give any CEO is to adopt and to effectuate the vision that the mayor has laid out. I think the mayor Coming from Chicago Public Schools as an educator, both in middle school and high school, as a parent who has children in those schools, as an organizer who constantly fought for full funding for schools, who better to be articulating the vision and enforcing that it needs to actually manifest? I think he knows the visceral reaction when you go into a school and you are asked to literally make lemonade out of lemons. I think he knows when he drops his children off at school and how he has to take his kids all the way to the South Side to get the types of resources that he wishes they could afford on the West Side, but they're not available. And so those types of things are not radical. All we want to make sure is that young people and children are wrapped around and able to live up to their fullest potential, and the adults around them have what they need to do that.
You know, this seems very complicated, but for parents who are watching right now and seeing this public rift with CPS, what do you want to tell parents who are trying to understand?
Mm-hmm. I think the vision of the mayor is simple, right? We want to transform the Chicago public school system. For too long, we have been living in chaos. For too long, we have accepted subpar standards. For too long, we have adopted status quo, which is closing 50 schools. We have allowed previous appointed boards to do a no-bid contract for a former employer of the CEO. We have allowed the books to be cooked in terms of graduation rates. We have privatized services and paid more money but received less quality. All of that is disruption and chaos. I can tell you I have two children in Chicago Public Schools, one in a neighborhood school, one in a magnet school. I walked my son to school every day this week. There was no chaos. There was no disruption. Teachers were teaching. Support staff were wrapping around. My principal assured us that he was there as the instructional leader. Our local school councils are making sure that our schools are following their school improvement plans. This is really about transformation, and we're at a turning point, and the mayor is not afraid to make those decisions.
And, you know, we only have a couple seconds, but how would you say to those parents again, how is this turmoil going to affect their school or their child?
Day-to-day operations have not been affected. I actually served on the State Board of Education, and when you are a board member, you are making policy decisions at a 30,000-foot level. And what I can tell you is that day-to-day operations are functioning, and the site-based management teams, your local school councils, really have the deepest impact on how those schools are run, plus the principals. And as I said, principals are showing up every day. Teachers are showing up every day. Children are learning. Let us work out these details, because this is really the brink of educational transformation.
Well, thank you for taking the time for being here.
Thank you.
And if you're looking for more content on the complicated issues that are facing our city, sign up for our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, and visit WTTW.com/newsletter to have it in your inbox tomorrow morning. Up next, meet the Young Lords of Lincoln Park. The Young Lords of Lincoln Park went from street gang members to revolutionaries. They organized and fought against several injustices, especially gentrification. And a new Chicago Stories documentary outlines their entire story. Let's take a look.
In the turbulent streets of 1960 Chicago, a fierce struggle unfolded.
They were driving us out. They didn't want us. They're killing us. They literally want to kill us.
On one side, the power.
The city of Chicago. In effect, the federal government was about to devastate their community.
On the other side, the people.
It was a perfect storm. Communities were ripe for rebellion.
And here to talk more about the history and current activity of their organization are Omar Lopez, an original member of the Young Lords and executive director of Calor, and Paul Mireles, the deputy chairman of the New Era Young Lords. Thank you both for joining us. You know, I got a chance to watch some of the documentary, and it's just remarkable to see that piece of history that took place in that neighborhood. And Omar, I want to head back to the 1950s. At that time, Lincoln Park was known as one of the poorest neighborhoods in Chicago. The population was mostly white until Puerto Ricans started to arrive in the area. Tell me a little bit more about your story and how you got involved with the Young Lords.
Well, I got involved because I was a teenager at the time. And we had communications. I lived in Humboldt Park, and we had communications with the gangs in Lincoln Park. And that's how we became, you know, we became acquainted with each other. That's how we started. So we were aware of what was going on in both neighborhoods, Lincoln Park and Humboldt Park at that time. But it, the concentration of Puerto Rican families was really in at that point in Lincoln Park. That's where everything was going on.
And when you started to, you know, be more involved with the Young Lords, what was your role?
I became the Minister of Information for the Young Lords. That simply meant that I was in charge of all the communications that were coming out of the organization, slogans, the newspaper, putting out leaflets, things like that. But, you know, we were also involved in all the other programs, but those were the specific tasks that I had with the Young Lords.
And Omar, you officially joined the New Era Young Lords in 2021 and helped build the Illinois chapter. And through that process, you had conversation with previous Young Lords, including Omar. How has their history helped shape how you organize in the community today?
So their history has helped in many different ways. I've used it as a stepping stone to understand the systematic issues that they faced back in the 60s and how that relates to the work that we're still doing today. In many cases, we'll say like the actors and the wording around certain politics have changed, but for the most part, the systematic structures are still there and still present in our community. So when I look back at how the Young Lords had to move then and what we need to do now, it's still relevant. We still have food deserts and food disparity. We still have housing issues and crisis. There's still police terrorism. I will go a little bit beyond just common police brutality because terrorism affects the mind and how you react every day. And so it's a lot more complicated than just speaking out about it as brutality.
And Paul, you mentioned that you were in high school when you learned about the Young Lords.
Yes.
What attracted you to them?
So I actually went to grade school in Lincoln Park. I went to Abraham Lincoln Elementary, which is only a couple blocks away from the Old Stone Academic Building that was taken over in the documentary. Going to school there, from first grade to eighth grade, I had no idea that there was Puerto Ricans that were just in that community a decade earlier.
So, 'cause it looks so different.
Yes. And so this is 85, 86, around there. And so when I got into high school, as I got older, that's when I started to look at how Puerto Rican issues and Mexican and Latino issues, and also how they overlapped with a lot of the black issues. And the black community, and so that's kind of where I started to dig into
it. You felt that connection.
Yes.
And Omar, the documentary touches on several significant moments. One in particular was the killing of Manuel Ramos, another member of the Young Lords. He was shot by an off-duty officer. This tragedy led to forming alliances with other groups like the Rainbow Coalition. What did that moment bring forth for the Young Lords at that time?
Well, the killing of Manuel Ramos was pivotal in the development of the organization because at the beginning, our chairman, Chacha, was having a hard time convincing the members of the Young Lords to become political. They wanted to remain in the social club, petty crime, that type of thing, and Chacha wanted to move them forward. And of course, he told them why, you know, because of the police brutality, the terrible housing. It wasn't until Manuel Ramos was killed. Unfortunately, that's at the point in which the rest of the members that were resisting change decided, yes, you know, this is what we have to move. We have to move forward. We have, especially because they felt they had no recourse after Manuel was shot and killed. They didn't see any action against the off-duty policeman that killed him. So that was pivotal in the development of the organization. I think from there on, it was a
Do you remember being scared at that time? What did you feel?
You know, when you're living that situation, it's not necessarily that you're not scared. You know, you're developing ways of navigating, you know, all of that violence. I think if you think back, then you begin to say, well, yeah, I was crazy, you know.
But you did it. I mean, you created health clinics, fed the community. I mean, how important was that for the people in that neighborhood?
It's absolutely necessary. We did that because there was a need for that. The families were not getting adequate health care. They were not having decent housing. And that was our response, you know, once we became political, that was our response to the needs of the community. We always said we serve the people. And so those were the things that really the Young Lords are also known for, not just the confrontations with police, but also the kinds of survival programs.
For what they did.
Yeah.
And we only have time for one other question, but I want to go to you, Paul. What do you think the legacy of the Young Lords did for not only Chicago, but the country?
The legacy for me, it inspired a new generation. We see that with the new era and the work that we're doing. But it also, like I said before, it gave us that stepping stone. It allowed us to understand certain things. And it was unique in the way where they did start off as a social club. And then through a series of circumstances, eventually did go political. And when you look at that in the significance of our communities now in the state of Chicago now, you see that there is a need for that. More young people getting politically involved and active. So,
well, thank you. We're going to have to leave it at that. So I'll definitely recommend people to go watch it. Thank you for both of you.
Thank you.
To learn more about Chicago's history with the Young Lords of Lincoln Park, be sure to catch the new Chicago Stories documentary, which premieres tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Now back with more just in a moment. Stay with us. Organization is urging residents, especially Latinos, to become organ donors. According to the Gift of Hope Organs and Tissue Donor Network, 95% of people in the U.S. support donation, but less than 60% are registered donors. We visit a family with long roots in Chicago as they share how organ donation touched their lives.
This was his 70th
birthday for Dad.
Yeah.
A home full of memories and a family missing their father.
My dad was the patriarch of our family. He was a kind person. He had a warm smile.
It's okay.
And he was very loved.
Aurelio Salamanca was 78 years old when he died from heart failure earlier this year.
I grew up seeing him as like a superhero, you know. Like, nothing could hurt him.
For Maria Salamanca, losing her husband and travel partner of 56 years is a process.
Lo que más extraño es que era muy cariñoso conmigo. Le gustaba bailar mucho. Su presencia es la que extraño.
His family describes him as hardworking and giving. When he died, the family received a call from the organization Gift of Hope asking about the possibility of a donation to help others.
He donated tissue from his body, bones from both arms and legs, and
eye tissue.
Aurelio was a registered donor.
It's a beautiful thing that he keeps on leading by example, even in his death. And for Latinos, it's such a taboo, right, to talk about.
Janet Dominguez from Gift of Hope says she's been working to dismantle the myths surrounding organ and tissue donation. She developed a statewide Hispanic program for the organization.
It is hard for someone to understand that one individual can actually help save up to 8 lives and enhance the lives of other 25.
Dominguez says the Latino community is one of the groups with the highest need for organ transplants.
Yet we are the least group to donate, let alone to register. It is important because I know we can make a difference.
Do you guys want coffee or tea?
Me siento agradecida a Dios, me siento agradecida por la pareja que tuve y que sé que van a estar lo que sirvió de su persona para otras personas.
Fueron a la India.
As they look through photos, the family shares what life was like for them in the early 70s, selling tacos in Humble Park, something they did for more than 40 years, while Aurelio also was in the midst of a long career with the CTA.
He was raised by a single mom in the poorest neighborhood of Mexico City, and coming here and giving us this life and opening up all types of doors for us is unbelievable.
A father of four with 13 grandchildren.
Him being a registered donor and giving back is something that everyone should consider.
And the Gift of Hope says Aurelio Salamanca's donation may help more than 75 people. What a beautiful gift. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30, 7 and 10 for the weekend review. Now, from all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Buenas noches.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its 20 attorneys recognized in the 2025 edition of the Best Lawyers in America.